KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and a visiting research collaborator at Princeton University's Center for Information Technology Policy. Today, I'm very excited to have on a member of the European Parliament, Mariette Schaake, who has been a guest that was referred to me by a former guest, Lucevice van der Laan, who was on a few years ago discussing technology and democracy in Europe and the role of technology in the operation of government. When I had Lucevice on the show afterwards, I chatted with her about guests that she would recommend to come on Hearsay Culture, and she immediately recommended Mariette, and so we have been feverishly scheduling this interview, and I'm very excited to have Mariette on in the middle of meetings in the European Parliament. We are recording this show using my old-fashioned method on my end, the telephone, and Mariette is in studios in the EP. By way of very brief background, because I want to dive right into our discussion, Mariette has been serving as a member of the European Parliament for the Dutch Democratic Party since 2009. She's also the ALDE coordinator of the International Trade Committee, and so there is a focus that we'll talk about a bit today involving trade. She is focused on the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, the TTIP, which is slowly getting on the radar screen here in the United States as the United States winds up the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations. She also focuses heavily on human rights issues as well as technology, and she is the vice president of the ALDE delegation for relations to the United States. So we have someone on the show who is a wonderful guest to discuss Hearsay Culture topics. I'm excited to have her on. We're recording on October 26, 2015. And Mariette, thank you so much for joining us and finding time in your busy schedule to chat with us today.
You're very welcome. I'm sorry it was a bit complicated sometimes. The time difference doesn't help, but I'm really happy to be on your show.
A pleasure. Mariette, the audience for Hearsay Culture is international, but obviously there are many listeners who are in the United States. Perhaps you could talk a bit more about your background and ALDE and its place in the EU's political spectrum.
Sure. Well, I have a relationship with the United States that's been running since I was 17 and left for a gap year after my high school to a liberal arts college in Ohio. And after that, I also studied American studies. I have a master's degree in American studies. And I think I caught the fever there because I turned returned back later as a Lantos fellow with the late Congressman Lantos, who was really not only a champion for transatlantic relations, but also for bipartisanship. And, you know, that spirit and him in person are definitely missed. But I learned a lot from working on international relations and human rights there, and have always kept a connection to the United States, now serving as the vice president of the U.S. delegation of this European Parliament, which, you know, allows me to use the knowledge and experience to continue to build stronger transatlantic relations, which I think we still very much need. And I do this as a liberal member of European Parliament. I'm from the Netherlands, and my political party is a progressive liberal party, liberal in the European sense of the word, which is slightly different from the American connotation of the word liberal. But we are in the middle of the political spectrum. We believe that government should only do what is necessary, but have a very strong profile on civil liberties, including online. And I hope that gives you an idea of where I come from. But you can also, and listeners can also find out a lot more by looking online and social media. That's why I try to share a lot of the work that I do.
Yes, and for listeners who want to do that, it's mariettschaake.eu. And we'll mention then, we'll post the web address when we post the show. Mariette, because Hearsay Culture is a long-form interview, we have a little time to dive into topics, which is one of the fun things about the show. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be useful, again, recognizing that this is basic stuff for European listeners, but for those who haven't focused on the EP, perhaps you could describe the role of the European Parliament, which I think offers context for the policy questions that we're going to dive into in a moment.
Yeah, definitely. I would compare the EU level of decision making to the federal level in the United States. So it is the nationwide or the continent-wide, in our case, level of decision-making. And so there are three institutions. One is called the European Council, which consists of the governments of the member states of the European Union. And they come together in different formations. Sometimes the prime ministers come together, sometimes the finance ministers come together, sometimes the transport ministers come together, but they're all serving in their respective member state governments. And then there's the European Commission, which in my opinion is too large, but there is one commissioner from each EU member state. And these commissioners have substantial or topical portfolios. So there is a commissioner for international trade. There is a commissioner for transportation. There is a commissioner for culture and education, things like this. So this is the way that they divide their tasks, and they are responsible for directorates general, which are kind of like ministries where a lot of bureaucrats work and implement the policies that are proposed or write them and, you know, draft the legal texts and have the expertise in these different fields. And then there's the European Parliament, and we are the representatives of the European people. So we are elected in our home states, in my case, the Netherlands. Our country has a national platform. Some larger member states have different districts. In the European Parliament elections, people can vote for different political parties, different representatives that then represent the citizens that have voted for them, but in broader political families. So it is not only the political party itself that I'm serving on or for. We sit together in a broader political family, which in my case is called the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe. And we are the fourth largest political family in the European Parliament. But we are what we call here, and I think it's the same term in the United States, the kingmakers. So very often our vote determines where the majority of the House goes. And that's a position that, of course, we seek to use to have as strong as possible a mark of our political ideas, what our voters expect from us on any piece of legislation that leaves this parliament.
So, Mariachi, let me ask one more very basic question before we dive into your policy map, which is tailor-made for Hearsay Culture and the topics we talk about. You know, overall, as we're recording on October 26th, there are certainly some issues that the Atlantic Partnership, as it were, is discussing right now. But overall, what's your sense of American-EU relations at the moment, which will have relevance to some of the policy questions we talk about?
Well, I think we're at a crossroads. In much of Europe, the foundation for the current transatlantic relation is very much the period post the Second World War, where my parents' generation fundamentally considers Americans as liberators, liberators of Europe in its darkest hours. But since the end of World War II, of course, a lot has happened. And I'm afraid that some of the policy decisions that the United States governments have made, such as engaging or intervening in Iraq or Afghanistan, but also more recently the revelations about the practices by the National Security Agency, have really shifted what people may think when they're a bit older, considering the Americans as liberators, to, you know, some people considering American policy to be more occupying, to be less respectful of fundamental values that we cherish in Europe. And so I think that there has been an erosion of trust, and there is a real need to redesign and redefine the transatlantic relation for a young generation. I think it would be a grave mistake to perceive the transatlantic relation to be solid and static the same way for generations as we or for decades as we've seen. I think we are at a crossroads, at a turning point, and it is key that the young generation shapes a transatlantic relation in a way that is appropriate for modern times. And I still think, and I still principally believe, that the open societies of this world, the democracies of this world, should really work together to strengthen these universal values, which are coming under pressure in international organizations by demographic change, because repressive regimes are becoming more sophisticated as well. And I believe that it is primarily the US and Europe that together should give more meaning and depth to democratic values globally.
We're chatting with Mariette Schake, member of the European Parliament, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Mariette, you brought up the Snowden revelations and the documents ultimately that showed the extensive spying through the National Security Agency, not just in Europe but also domestically in the U.S. and elsewhere. Let me ask you this question, which I do think contextualizes the broad policy discussion we're going to get into in a moment, because I think it gives perhaps a sense of what that damage is that you referred to with regard to the U.S. and EU relationship. So the Snowden revelations, aside from the privacy concerns, which were massive, and the questions of how little notice or any notice was given to anyone involving this behavior, was met with one interesting pushback position that I want to get your reaction to. And those who, at least some commentators who were focusing on the history of intelligence gathering, going back, to World War II, had made the comment that, look, directly, everyone's doing it. And so the notion that anyone, particularly at an elected level in Europe or elsewhere, is surprised is questionable, that position says, because that same behavior is going in all directions. So what's your reaction to that? And I don't know what you want to call it, a defense, a pushback, a dismissive attitude. But what's your response to that kind of everyone's doing it reaction to the Snowden revelations generally?
Well, then I think if that's your thesis, or if that's the comment, it means everybody has to work harder to at least ensure democratic and judicial oversight over intelligence gathering. And I generally believe two wrongs don't make a right. It doesn't really help to say, well, we did it, but then you also did it, and so now nothing to discuss. I think that indeed for politicians and people in leadership positions, this may not have been as much of a surprise. But for citizens, a lot of people were shocked, not only at the extent to which intelligence gathering was being done in a sophisticated and massive scale in the U.S. or by the U.S. through the use of the internet and new technology companies, of which, of course, Silicon Valley-based companies are often the most powerful. So I think a lot of people are quite overwhelmed. But at the same time, I think there are historic explanations for the sensitivities in Europe. It is not that long ago that significant parts of the current European Union were governed by regimes that actually spied on their citizens in a systematic manner. I don't know if any of the listeners or if you have seen this movie called The Lives of Others, but I would certainly recommend it. I mean, this was happening in Germany to people that are still alive today. And they can go back to the Stasi archives and see whether their neighbor, their spouse, their best friend, or their sister was spying on them. And so I think that this recent history in Europe has made people more sensitive, and I think that we should all aspire, as I mentioned before, to actually give meaning and depth to the promise of democratic and open societies. This is certainly a promise that many Americans embrace. They value the First Amendment of their Constitution. We've seen people like Secretary Clinton, when she was still Secretary of State, be an advocate for internet freedom. Well, I do think that's an opportunity, but it must have meaning. And in that sense, I think we should all really take a pause and learn from the Snowden revelations and the knowledge we now have of what is technically possible and what abuse of power is happening. And really ask ourselves, what does it do to our credibility in a changing world? What does it do to the way in which people that are repressed in many countries across the world, looking to the EU, looking to the United States for an appreciation and a support for their universal human rights and fundamental freedoms, that we are now less able to speak with moral authority to these people, and particularly to the regimes that are repressing them. And I think that's a big loss for everybody.
Now, actually, let's turn to, because we're going to come back to these issues. And again, Hearsay Culture is a show where we discuss your policy areas at length, particularly issues like internet freedom and the digital agenda. We've spent more time recently on international trade because of TTIP and TPP. ACTA was a topic earlier, dual-use technology, so open data, copyright. As I said, as far as a guest for Hearsay Culture, your suite of focuses is right in the wheelhouse.
Yeah, it felt like I could tick all the boxes.
Yes, no, you could. You could. This is, and which is why Luzovai's recommendation was so wonderful. Tell us a bit, about how you came to these topics, which at least superficially look like they might be disparate, but actually have some interesting relating threads. Mm-hmm. How do you tie these the topics I mentioned, or others, together in the work that you do in the EP?
So my work is always focused on what I call Europe in a changing world. A changing world meaning what kind of foreign and security policy issues are important for us, particularly the countries right next to Europe, so the ring of countries around us, where I think we can have most impact, and certainly the challenges that they face impact us. So our fates are tied, and we should consider that more proactively. So that's the foreign policy aspect. And then foreign trade is really, I think, the other side of foreign policy. You know, there's on the one hand human rights, which I believe are key, and I'm very involved in, and on all kinds of levels, from seeking to get individuals out of prison to ensuring that human rights clauses are parts of trade agreements. This is something that is one of my priorities. But then trade is really interesting, because here, too, we see that the world is changing quite fast, that emerging economies seek development without much consideration for people and planet oftentimes. And while, of course, we welcome the economic development and people stepping out of poverty and getting more opportunities as a result of economic development, I think we have to think now in what kind of set of rules and standards and principles we want to embed this trade. And I believe that when the U.S. and the EU work together, they can set higher global standards. And so for me, this also is a topic that very much fits in policies that need to be made now in order to make the EU robust and resilient and a values-based global actor for the next generation. And then thirdly, I've always been fascinated by technological developments. I studied new media at the University of Amsterdam when I was still a student. And I actually also kind of stumbled upon ran into the relation between technology and foreign policy when, in the year that I was first elected, 2009, there were massive uprisings in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And it really fascinated me. And I was so struck by the different worlds that young people there, and I myself, I was 30 at the time, were living in. I mean, by criticizing my government, by being vocal and saying what I believed was just, I got elected to the European Parliament. And people my age and oftentimes younger, doing the same thing there, got beaten up, put into prison, sometimes executed and tortured. And really paid a huge price for seeking a more just and free society. And by communicating with these people through social media, but also looking into what had really happened with these protest movements, we all know, I think, the stories of, the use of social media help people get organized, access information, share some of these terrible human rights abuses all over the world. But there was also the other side, which is the way in which governments used technology really as extensions of their repressive practices and became also much more sophisticated in using mass surveillance or tracking and tracing systems or monitoring networks over their mobile networks, all kinds of ways to make sure that dissidents, journalists, opposition figures were kept under control. And this dynamic fascinated me, and I began to look at, were European technologies used? What can we do about it? So I guess these might seem like different topics from a bit of a distance, but for me, they're all interlinked in ensuring and looking for ways in which the EU can take responsibility to ensure that there is more freedom more justice for people globally, even in a changing world.
We're chatting with Marian Cheshake, a member of the European Parliament on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, Marian, is that, you know, we've chatted about it a little bit. You know, I come back to these issues involving privacy, but which, of course, as you mentioned, not only The Lives of Others, which I agree is a wonderful film, but also, you know, the efforts in the EU to create privacy directives and the right to be forgotten. It is a very, I think, a fairly different concept of privacy in the EU versus the United States. To the extent, and this is, I want to get into the digital single market here. You know, to the extent that you look at privacy as a topic, do you think that, especially given what you had mentioned about the Snowden leaks, but also more generally about how information is shared, not only within countries but internationally, that privacy and discussion of privacy is a way to bridge some of these differences? Or do you see privacy as almost being a wedge issue between the U.S. and the EU, and quite frankly, perhaps the U.S. and EU on one side and other parts of the world? How does privacy fit into this panoply of issues?
Well, I think we have to be careful here. I often hear, you know, that people in the U.S. think differently about privacy and fundamental rights online than Europeans do. And of course, I, you know, hinted at cultural and historic backgrounds that could be one reason why there is perhaps a more sensitive response to some of the practices like those done by the NSA with, you know, help and use of large tech companies that operate globally. But I also think, and perhaps more importantly, think that these are discussions that polarize our own societies. Within the US, I see a very lively debate on what is the appropriate role of the state, ranging from, you know, left to right, from progressive to conservative. I see the same in the EU, in our own societies. I mean, there are those who say, look, we can sacrifice some of our fundamental rights and freedoms, including the right to privacy, if it brings us more security. I believe this is a false dichotomy, but it is an argument that I hear both in the US and in Europe. I get lobbied myself by civil society organizations, citizens, people who have startups, of who I know they live in the United States. And they're asking for more protection of rights. So I don't think that this is a division that runs, you know, that is separated by the Atlantic Ocean. I think that these are discussions that are dividing our societies and sometimes generations, or sometimes incumbents and newcomers. It really depends on the angle you take. But I would hate for the whole discussion about what is the appropriate role of states in a hyper-connected world, what is an real and genuine approach to security also online. I would hate for these questions to be painted in a US versus EU way. I think it doesn't do justice to the way you know, it looks in reality, and also it undermines our ability to work together globally, which is another point that you mentioned and I do think is important.
And Marietje, yeah, the reason why I asked the question is in part because, and I think it's no question about it, here in the United States, as we are still in the early but very active stages of a presidential election process, already we can see, at least consuming it here, that a good number of candidates will be, as is somewhat traditional, engaging in the us versus them language, which is part of why Hearsay Culture exists, to kind of build those bridges and particularly have communities, both scholarly communities, but also to some degree political communities, discuss things and interact in ways that they haven't in the past. Let me turn to the digital single market, which is an interesting concept and one that I think some people may be familiar with, but many may be surprised to hear is part of the policy discussion going on in the EU. What is it? And talk about, if you would, a bit of the three pillars that have been identified for what we'll call DSM.
Yeah, I'll be happy to talk about that. But let me first welcome your, you know, global perspective and looking at the rest of the world. I think if more people in the United States would do that, if more media would do that, we would live in a better world. So, okay, back to the digital single market, which the idea of European Union cooperation between different member states is to remove unnecessary barriers. And so one of the big successes of the EU has been the so-called single market. So the idea is that there's free flow of goods and capital and services across different EU member states, much like how the United States operates. But this single market does not quite exist yet. It's not perfect offline, but it certainly is not really existing when it comes to a digital single market. And so the goal of the European Commission, which is the one that proposes this legislation, is to do three broad things. One is to give better access for consumers and businesses to digital goods and services across Europe. So basically to remove the notion of barriers for people when they, for example, shop online or want to roll out a new service across all of the EU. The second pillar is to make sure that the right conditions apply and that there's a level playing field. So essentially that the rules are the same for everybody and that it doesn't really matter if you want to operate a business in Finland or in Spain, that the experience would be the same and that laws on VAT or on applying for copyright licenses could be similar, which now is certainly not the case. And the third pillar is quite general, but the idea is to maximize growth and the potential of Europe's digital economy. And these three pillars are really then subdivided in loads of proposals, which many of them still have to be worked out in detail. So they range from better package and parcel delivery to consumer rights, which are more uniform, or ending this thing called geo-blocking that we have here. I don't think you have the same in the United States, but geo-blocking is really the idea that countries can hold content within their territory. So that if you are watching an online news program, for example, if I would want to tonight here in Strasbourg, where I have to go for work 1 week a month, if I want to watch a live stream of the evening news or a debating program after the news, I'm unable to. And if I try, I will see a message which comes from the public broadcaster in the Netherlands, where I am a taxpayer, which basically says you are not entitled, you are not allowed to watch this content in the place where you are now, which I know this sounds surreal, but that's the reality we live in and we would like to change. So the end to geo-blocking is another one of the ideas that is part of this digital single market. So you'll see, and the list goes on and on, that a lot of these proposals are quite practical and are so practical that lots of people in the US might think, well, I mean, hasn't that already been taken care of? Isn't that already the practice that is happening today? And the answer is no. And so creating a digital single market is very much about removing those unnecessary barriers, making the same rules for everybody and making it easier to, you know, see content or communicate with people from all sides of the EU.
So, Mariette, I know that you're on a tight schedule and we have about 20 minutes, if I'm doing the math correctly, in terms of your time. So I'm just going to simply say you're listening to KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture with Mariette Shaki from the EP, and we're going to get right back into the interview. I do want to cover a few more topics in the 20 or so minutes we have left, Mariette, which in relate directly to DSM, I mentioned TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership. This is a negotiation in its early stages. How does TTIP fit into the very issues you just mentioned? I also want to ask you a little bit about the secrecy around it and whether you think there is a place for more information about the negotiations being made public. Now, the EP and the EU have actually been more transparent than the United States in sharing position papers, but do you think that there is a place for sharing, let's say, a negotiating text with the public prior to the agreement being finalized?
All right, thank you. Those are only a few small questions, so I'm going to try to speak even faster because people accuse me of speaking fast.
Yeah.
No, it's fine. But I'm going to try to remember all of them. But otherwise, I'm sure you'll remind me.
So basically,
the proposals on a digital single market have nothing to do with international trade negotiations at the moment. I mean, this is, you know, much more homework that we have to do in the EU. And then the negotiations between the EU and the US are, you know, sort of a different, different road. Parallel tracks, basically. And the idea behind negotiating a trade investment partnership between Europe and the United States is actually not, it's not rocket science. But if we could remove some of the unnecessary barriers like bureaucratic burden or tariffs that still are you know, applied to certain products, then we can give entrepreneurs and exporters a little bit more efficiency, which is not a luxury we should disregard in times of a crisis that has really, you know, hit the US and the EU equally significantly. So the idea is to help encourage exports, make them a bit more easy by removing unnecessary barriers. And I'll come back to what is a necessary barrier and an unnecessary one later. But it would also allow us, and this is what I briefly mentioned earlier in the show, is it would allow us together to think of rules and standards, which if we introduce them together on behalf of the two most wealthy and open economic blocks, chances are that they would become global rules. And I'm thinking about, you know, products on which we don't really have rules yet, where we haven't been developing in different directions accidentally. But for example, think of the electric car. There will be questions about, you know, when can an electric car be considered sustainable? There's all kinds of criteria, and many people may think, well, electric cars are always sustainable, but that's debatable. And so if the EU and the US would together adopt a similar standard, a high standard, the highest global standard. And if we would then introduce all kinds of criteria, like the same sockets or the same measurements or the same safety rules, then we would at least not accidentally part ways in the which we do, in the way in which we do things, which, you know, sometimes when you think about it, it's quite surreal that, for example, in the United Kingdom and other EU member states, they drive on a different side of the road. And if you would imagine redesigning that today, nobody would have made that decision. Everybody would have, you know, probably, well, I don't know, maybe some stubborn people, but generally, if you think about efficiency and if you think about what it means for those who have to make cars, you would never think about different systems within the same continent that is so, you know, interdependent economically by now. So the idea is to see what we can do together. Nobody's forcing anything. It's not going to have to be the lowest common denominator, but it's about removing unnecessary barriers and setting high standards globally. And I think we should be able to do that in a way that benefits both sides and that also benefits values globally, such as, you know, environmental protection or labor standards or food safety. But the discussion we're facing here in Europe is kind of a mirror discussion of what you're facing in the US when it's about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So on the part of a lot of Europeans, there's a real fear that American standards are lower and that we're going to be sort of pulled down by this agreement. But, you know, we're clarifying the kinds of commitments we're seeking from the negotiators and, well, just making sure that these concerns will not materialize.
And so, I'm sorry, Patrick.
No, I think you wanted to know about transparency.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, thank you.
And so I think both concrete results in the negotiations and access to information are the best medicine against, you know, myths and questions that maybe, you know, I can answer. I'm responsible for my whole political group, so this European group of liberal and democratic parties for TTIP. I spend a lot of time reading the negotiating documents, reading expert opinions, meeting with people, reading studies, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, there is always going to be people who don't trust politicians or who think that I'm, you know, biased. And I would love to give them more access to the documents. And I think we've come a long way in Europe. We've really pushed our negotiators hard to put a lot of information online, and they have. position papers of the European Parliament, European Commission, excuse me, are all online. There are regular stakeholder meetings, and we're expecting more efforts to ensure also that members of national parliaments, so sort of our state parliaments, can access the documents in a smoother way than they can now. But we also hit a wall when it comes to the American approach, which is much less transparent. And of course, when you're talking about consolidated texts, so texts that reflect both EU and US texts, we can only go so far as where the EU has authority, right? So if the US says, well, we don't want to publish this, then the EU can stand on its head, but it's not going to be able to publish it.
So yeah, and that gets into a fascinating area that I would love to cover now, but I feel like there's other issues that have a wider berth of interest. So I'm gonna turn a little bit here to an interesting critique, or actually that you've written on your website about internet freedom and information war. And if I might, with regard to the Russian narrative on the downing of Malaysian Air Flight 17 over Ukraine, you wrote, quote, "The open internet is increasingly the arena of clashes between top-down control by states and bottom-up empowerment of individuals." And in this writing, you critique the concepts of information control and strategic narratives that, in your opinion, have dominated discussion thus far. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you define internet freedom and this information war as you see it?
Sure, yeah. Internet freedom is really, it's a very broad term. I'm aware of that. I prefer talking about digital freedoms, but it's about people's fundamental rights and freedoms also when they're using new technologies. There are, of course, advanced ways of repressing people, mass surveillance, hacking into people's systems, exfiltrating information, all kinds of tools that are becoming more widely available are getting smaller and faster and cheaper every day, but that are not going to help people's fundamental rights and freedoms and can actually endanger them quite seriously in many parts of the world. So I think looking at the way in which technological developments have changed human rights is a responsibility that decision makers should take. And then your other question was about information war or information manipulation, which I think is a field that deserves more assessment. What we see in Europe is that, for example, the Russian state-owned and state-sponsored media channels are advancing in Europe. So the Russian regime is investing quite heavily in media that reaches European people. And that really, I don't think their journalism meets criteria that I would consider quality journalism or ethical journalism. It's really, oftentimes much more in the direction of propaganda, of misinformation, of confusing people, and it has real consequences. And I think, the best answer is not to do the same thing, which some people are suggesting. We need counter-propaganda, etc. No, on the contrary, I think what is the best answer to, top-down, few voices being spread many times is to have an open debate and to show people that in Europe, people are free to challenge each other's thoughts, to question what is written in the newspaper or what is said by the government in an open manner. And quite frankly, in Russia, if journalists do that, we've seen all too many people being murdered, intimidated, aggressively silenced, and no propaganda channel or no propaganda machine can change that reality, which sadly is now one that the Russian people are suffering from. And the strategy is, of course, to distract attention from domestic problems oftentimes by, for example, focusing now on Syria or on what is wrong with the United States or Europe, etc.
And so, Marietje, I know we have maybe about 10 minutes tops left. There was a story today, or this weekend, I should say, in the New York Times involving, and speaking of Russia, and I wanted to ask you not about this particular story, but the context of Russia and information policy. A story about increased apparent activity involving the Russian Navy monitoring what at least unnamed intelligence agencies believe are the undersea cables that, of course, connect the world via the internet, and that the idea being that those cables could be cut as an offensive measure against the world, but particularly against the United States and Europe. As Russia as an entity obviously has become much more aggressive in the last couple of years, and I certainly don't have to tell you any of that. How do you see Russia playing here and influencing information policy and information sharing as we understand it? What do you see as the geopolitics there? And I recognize that I'm giving you a couple of minutes to answer a very complex question.
Well, generally, I believe that there are two schools of thought, if you will, or two kinds of practices that we're seeing developing in a hyper-connected reality that internet and other technologies have enabled. So on the one hand, it's easier than ever. I mean, we're talking now while we are halfway across the world in a distance. And it's very easy for people to connect. It's much easier for people to access information despite living in a closed society. And the empowerment of the individual has in potential really increased with the help of new technologies. But of course, the sophistication with which governments, and I think it's very important to distinguish between the people in Russia and the government in Russia, but with which, for example, the Russian government, but also other governments that are authoritarian in nature, that seek to strengthen their grip, their monopoly on information in order to stay in power, because they fear that if they would be challenged, they would lose. They have also discovered the way in which technologies can be used. And so one school of thought and practice, or one idea of the best way to deal with these new technologies is that is developed by some of these states that think they should be the one in control. And then there's another school of thought which believes that individuals should be free and empowered to make their own decisions, also on governance. And so in the world of internet governance and thinking about that, there's this notion that if everybody's at the table, so private companies, civil society organizations, citizens and internet users, but also governments and international organizations, that they could sit together and make better decisions that are more supported and that are based on broader expertise. And these two streams are kind of clashing increasingly, and we see that governments such as the one in Russia are at least using the space that they have or the ability that they have to increase their grip and their way of monitoring and tracking people that are using the internet and new technologies.
We're chatting with Marietta Shaka, a member of the European Parliament at KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Marietta, let me ask you one more policy question before I ask kind of a closing question, because another topic that seems to run through your policy sphere is copyright broadly and the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement of a few years ago. What's your view on the status of copyright as a method to police information flow? What is its role, and where do you see it headed given the behaviors existing today?
Well, I think it depends on what you're specifically referring to. Maybe I don't understand your question completely, but basically...
Sure, let me fine-grain it for you. If we focus on issues like piracy,
yeah,
right, and the use of copyright law to protect copyright owners from the unauthorized distribution of their works across political boundaries, that's a different role for copyright than, say, the role of copyright to encourage speech through fair use, mm-hmm, which is different than the general idea, which varies between the United States and Europe, with regard to why we have copyright in the first place. Is it to create incentives? Is it because we believe that copyright is an extension of ourselves? So it's a complicated question, which I guess I'll summarize this way. Is copyright a law, in your view, a tool of controlling the movement of information, or should we view it a different way?
Well, I think it's become that. And that's also because the times in which copyright laws were designed were very different from the ones we live in now. We've gone from scarcity to abundance. We've found so many new opportunities to share information, to copy information without loss of quality. And still, there are business models that are based on the old structures, on scarcity and on you know, the profits that some of these gatekeepers or incumbents were used to making. And they are, of course, resisting any change to copyright law and, in fact, pushing for longer terms of protection. And I am worried about it because I think that we have to also safeguard the public interest. And, you know, we see outrageous practices where publicly funded research, for example, is being published by commercial publishers, and then publicly funded universities have to buy them back, buy the knowledge back for a very high subscription costs. And we see university professors saying no to this model any longer, and, you know, also using new technologies to organize peer review themselves and to make sure that what is researched and funded in the public interest actually remains in the public domain. And I would like to see more consideration for the public interest when we think about copyright, when we think generally about digitization and the new opportunities, but also challenges it brings. The space is easily being filled by businesses with a profit earmark, while democratic governments or governance is lagging behind. And this is something the public interest, open access, open data, open budgets, which I think is an important counterbalance to the profit-driven copyright police, which I sometimes call them.
Mariace, let me ask you one last question, which is, if you were flagging three issues that American listeners, the Hearsay Culture, should pay attention to in the work that you're doing under the heading of educating the public and the world, what would they be?
One thing that's quite dear to my heart, and it's going to change in the near future, is export controls of systems that are designed and marketed and sold for repression, so mass surveillance or exfiltration or hacking systems. I think this is an area where the EU and the US can work together. And it's, in my observation, quite absurd that a lot of people are concerned about cybersecurity. A lot of people claim to be concerned about people's human rights globally. But then there's hardly any transparency or accountability of this gray market of repression technologies. And I think that that is about to change. And I hope that a lot of people that care about the public interest and universal human rights will get involved. And we are aware, I am aware of the concerns that some security researchers have, but I am convinced that together, and I've been working with hackers and experts in this field to get it right, but I'm convinced we can develop smart policies. And I really look forward to making a step in the positive direction there. We have a very important vote coming up tomorrow on net neutrality, but generally any issue about the open internet and strengthening people's rights online, I believe, should be a universal one. And I would like to end this false dichotomy of sort of US versus EU on issues related to this. So I would encourage more cooperation. And I also observe global movements like the people protesting against SOPA, PIPA and OCTA all the same. And they were often Europeans and Americans and people from many other places in the world working together. And my last point would be, and I know that this could be a tricky one, but I do hope that your open-minded program and global outlook in your program might also incentivize people to look at the way in which the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership can be done the right way. Some of the information that's being shared is, a bit hyped, I would say. And what I would hope is that at the end of the road, and I think we'll have years of negotiations, particularly when You're about to enter, I think, what you call the silly season, right? The presidential election.
I think we're already in it.
Oh, yeah. Well, some people may argue you've never been out of it, but I'll leave that for another program. No, I'm sorry. That was not just kidding. But actually, no, we are worried that this whole presidential race is going to take over everything, that there will not be progress and that it's going to take many more years. But during these years, let's at least make sure that there is a substantial debate on the merits of rules-based trade in a changing world, which can, if done well, allow us to strive for higher standards, set global standards that do consider people and planet beyond just profit. And I think that that is really important.
Mariette Shaki, member of the European Parliament, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture, particularly between meetings. I know you're running off now, so I will simply say I look forward to staying in touch. I appreciate you taking the time to educate my listeners, and thank you kindly.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it. We hardly ever get so much time to share our thoughts, so it was a real treat. Thank you.
A pleasure. Hearsay Culture, and I should thank right up front, since I'm going to hang up in a moment, I should thank the radio engineers at the European Parliament who graciously are recording this interview for my use. So I appreciate that. I'm just going to do this really fast because I don't want to hold them up. We have a couple more guests coming up for this quarter on Hearsay Culture. Sam Brailovsky of the Library of Congress, this is National Sound Preservation Board, and Nato Thompson, author of Seeing Power, Art, and Activism in the 21st Century. Out of respect for these engineers, and on Hearsay Culture, I rarely these days get the opportunity to have someone else engineering the show. So I'll simply say Hearsay Culture is on KZSFM Stanford this quarter. It is on Fridays at 2 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU. You can also get the show by subscribing via podcast through Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, the website at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 243 prior shows as well as the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com, or again by going to the contact page on hearsayculture.com. Thank you much for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.